It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Leo's in Hawaii drinking a beverage with a tiny umbrella in it. My name's Mike Elgin, and I'm filling in for Leo. Jeff and Gina are here, and we'll be sifting through the aftermath of last week's Google I.O. Stick around. This Week in Google is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twig.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly, CacheFly.com.
This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 256, recorded July 2nd, 2014. A machete, a shotgun, and a votive candle. It's time for Twig, This Week in Google, where we cover all things cloudy and Googleicious. With us today is the usual cast of characters. I am not Leo Laporte. That's the bad news. The good news, we have Jeff and Gina with us, starting with Jeff Jarvis, professor of journalism at City University of New York. And I heard on this show that you've been recently anointed with total professorial powers. You cannot be touched.
Yes, that's true. And I have tenure, too, so
that's
heck with you. Yeah.
That, too. Why not? Boy, I wonder, we should have tenure here at Twit. That'd be great. Author of Public Parts, What Would Google Do? And Gutenberg the Geek. Also, you blog at buzzmachine.com. I love your blog. Always have. And I'm glad I'm here on this show. I always listen to the show, and it's great to be here. I can finally...
Glad to have you here.
Somebody will hear me when I talk it back at you guys. And Gina Trapani, creator of ThinkUp.com, host of Twit's All About Android, and founding editor of Lifehacker. How you doing, Gina?
Hello. Great to be here.
How did I not see either one of you at Google I.O.? I didn't see either one of you.
Because you were busy working, Mike.
You were working.
I don't remember that.
It was a busy couple of days.
Yeah,
it was.
It was crazy.
You know, the greatest thing, day two, I went to a session. I did this and that, but of course, most of them aren't meant for me. But I would just stand in the hall, and honest to God, one after another of you magnificent Twig fans would come up and say, "Hey, Jeff Jarvis, I'm a fan of Twig." And we'd take pictures, and it was just, I could have spent the whole day just talking to Twig fans. It was wonderful.
Those are definitely our people, aren't they, at Google I.O.? Yeah.
It was pretty awesome. One moment. There was one time they really feel like a celebrity. I had people stop and ask to take pictures with me, too. And I was like, this is crazy. I was telling my mom. She was just like, what? I was like, yeah, mom. Yeah. For real.
Same thing for me. You take one step out the door into the streets of San Francisco and you are nobody. So that was that was a lot of fun. So Google is buying or has bought Songza, a music play service that competes with the likes of all the music services. To me, in terms of functionality, in terms of its sense of curation, I think it competes very closely with Google, with Apple's Beats music service, kind of, sort of. Jeff and Gina, why did they buy this? We'll start with you, Jeff. Why did they buy this music service?
Come on, Gina first. They need music. I think it's simple as that, and I think they can go cheaper than Apple's gone with Beats, and these music services are going to get snapped up because they have an audience.
But did they? Does Google need cheaper? I mean, you know, it's like, you know, they throw around billions of dollars like it's nothing. And here they probably spent more than $39 million. The valuation was pegged at somewhere around $15 million, but it was apparently competition.
That's Padre's chocolate budget.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, yeah. Who can keep up with that?
It's not much. And I think that the truth is that at times Google does know it's build or buy, and times Google knows that it should buy, not build.
Well, so you obviously have an intimate familiarity with Google. The secret sauce of Songza is human curation. That doesn't sound like a Google thing to me.
Yeah, as we learned in the organization of I.O. a couple times last week, humans are not Google's specialty.
No.
I'm joking. I was very happy to be there. I'm not complaining at all. Just make it clear. Just make a little joke. Just a little joke about the lines. It's all, but it was really good. It was really good. I think Songza, I don't use it, so I don't know that much about it. So, Gina, do you use it?
I don't use Songza, but I do use Google Play Music a lot. And so it kind of makes sense to me that this, that Google would look to snap up a company like this for a relatively small price and Google scale, financially anyway, that can help them improve their, I listen to I'm Feeling Lucky Radio a lot. That's basically what I just do at this point. I just go into Google Play Music. It has my music. It knows what I like. I press I'm Feeling Lucky. And it's pretty good some of the time. So if an acquisition like this makes that better, I think it makes a lot of sense.
You know, one of the crazy things about Songza is that it changes the playlist based on your context. And that is a very Googly thing. It's also advertiser supported. Yes. That's a Googly thing. But the context even goes so far as a deal that they have with the Weather Channel that changes the songs based on the weather, based on your weather.
Well, of course, Mike, if this were bought by Facebook, they would know when you're sad because they made you sad. So they'd play you sad music and then play you happy music to make you happier. So they manipulate your feelings constantly, right?
I'm so glad you brought that up. Why don't we talk about that? Now, this really chaps my hide here, this Facebook thing, because for a number of reasons. Yesterday we talked on Tech News Today. We were talking to the person, Kashmir Hill at Forbes, who broke the story that, in fact, when they, in 2012, when they actually tested the feature to see if they can make people sad or happy based on what, you know, they're tweaking their feeds, that they didn't actually have explicit language in the terms of service talking about research and the sorts of things that they, in fact, did. Facebook countered to that, saying, oh, it's all about improving the service. That's what it was all about. That's always been in the terms of service. So that's one problematic aspect to this. But to me, this is an example of Facebook so, and probably Google too, they're so used to messing around and determining what we see and what we don't see, that the reasons for doing that are not as important to them as it probably is to the public. I mean, it's just like, you know, to actually affect people's moods. I mean, Gina, do you use Facebook at all?
I do use Facebook, and I thought about this a lot. And my first gut reaction, I'm sad to admit, you know, was very much the sort of, it made me sad. I kind of took this technologist view where I was like, well, companies A/B test things all the time, right?
Exactly.
Like so many products are constantly tweaking. Google does this. I mean, everything is run on an algorithm. Everything is data driven based on reactions and clicks, and everything's being adjusted. So it didn't surprise me at all that Facebook did this. I was a little surprised at the outcry about the ethics of it. I suppose the idea that users should have been informed in a more explicit way makes sense to me, but I was I think there was a lack of empathy about the communication about this, right? Like, the communication should have been clearer, that the terms of service wasn't enough. These folks should have been let know. But at the same time, I kind of was like, this is constantly going on. You know, how is this different than A/B testing a headline or an email subject line, which goes on constantly?
Exactly. And every marketer out there, every entertainment, every politician and political campaign does the same thing, but it's kind of a techno panic thing again, right? Facebook was tone deaf in the communication. You are absolutely right about that. They got kind of caught rather than being open about this. And there have been experiments in the past. I remember that Yahoo had a great lab that was A/B testing behavioral impact on people. I'm not against that in theory. But when it hurts your business because of the way it's discovered, then that's just stupid. And I think Sheryl Sandberg has basically said that they certainly had a communications problem on this.
Well, I think this is slightly different than your average garden variety technopanic. And I'm always with you on the technopanic argument, Jeff, that you make. But in this case, actually making people sad on purpose, that's an exaggeration. They didn't make that many people that sad.
No, but Mike, that's what every chick flick does.
Yeah, but people know it. I think a big part of this story that's interesting is the degree to which people are not aware that that algorithm, you know, noise filtering goes on. But let's do talk about the technopanic aspect of it. Let's say they discovered, which in fact they did, they came to the conclusion, one of the conclusions of the paper that was published around this, is that in fact mood is contagious. If they can tweak your news feed to be happier or sadder, you tend to post things that are happier or sadder. There's some question about whether it's good science, whether that's a legitimate conclusion, but that was their conclusion. So let's say that's true, and let's say they did conclude that, and that's the conclusion. So maybe Facebook wants to make your news feed a happy place. Maybe they decide that as a matter of policy, because nobody knows. This is the part that kind of bothers me. Nobody knows what their algorithms are. They even got rid of the name. It's sort of like in the Soviet Union when they used to erase people from the photographs. Too many people were throwing around the E word, edge rank. So they basically said, well, now it's not called EdgeRank anymore. It doesn't have a name. So now we can't really talk about it all that clearly. But they do have secret algorithms that nobody is aware of. They're changing constantly. They're testing them constantly. What if Facebook or some other social network decided to deliberately improve the service, right, by making it everybody happy? Jeff, is that a technopanic reaction as well?
I'll play an old tabloid guy. I'll play into this and panic you more. There was a hedge fund, and I wrote about this in Public Parts. A computer scientist at University of Indiana tracked six moods and their opposites with various keywords and found that he could predict the daily ups and downs in the Dow Jones with more than 90% accuracy. So guess what happened? The hedge fund hired his butt and they created a new hedge fund based on this. Now, the next step, I said at the time, the next step behind this is, of course, you'll try to manipulate the mood of the country because you're going to arbitrage that mood. And if you read the wonderful Michael Lewis book, Flash Boys, which I do recommend, it's phenomenal. It's not beyond Wall Street and marketers to do exactly that and to profit from it, to affect the mood of the country for a reason or another. That's possible to be there. But at some point, there are cashmere heels in the world. And at some point, you know, the truth will out and we'll figure it out. This reminds me of going back to the early days of television advertising. And I'm old enough to have been around almost then. When the panic of the time was that there was subliminal advertising and that things were shot at us in the screen and would convince us, you know, buy deodorant, you stink, and you start to believe it. Well, it was never really true. If we really believe that we are as a people such sheeples that a Facebook news feed could affect truly our entire mood and thus the country, then we got bigger problems, I think. Gina?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard because I feel like a lot of my friends would be really upset about me saying this right now, but because a lot of my friends, particularly in community management, were really upset about the fact that Facebook did not communicate this and that they were overusing their power. This is a power relationship and manipulating emotions is unethical. But I mean, if Facebook tweaks their newsfeed to make people happier when they use Facebook, how is that different than anybody building any product who's trying to create a better user experience, right? I mean, think about any sort of experience you have with a product. Of course, the maker is trying to make people feel happy or compelled to do anything. I mean, advertising manipulates our emotions. Music and movies manipulates our emotions. I think we know that. So this felt like, and also this finding that emotions are contagious. I mean, is this news really? I mean, we're empathetic beings. I mean, do we need a study on Facebook to find out that if you guys are sad, I'm also going to feel sad? Or if you're joyous and happy and upbeat, that's not going to be a little contagious? I mean, it just didn't seem like, news to me.
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like, I don't know. What do you think, Mike? You seem a little more critical about this
I'm critical for two reasons. The first reason is they don't make a super easy way for you to just turn it off. Google doesn't either. With Google, you can do noise filtering. You can choose a little bit or a lot, but you can't say, give me everything. I want the ability to just throw a switch that's right there, and everybody knows about that switch, where I just say, give me the fire hose. And then maybe I can decide for myself, it's too much. I want some noise filtering. I want some help. Of course, Facebook does now allow you to granular control of, you know, I want more of this, less of this. I don't want to hear from this person, whatever. That exists for power users. But for the most part, this whole algorithm thing, you mentioned that, you know, lots of things make us happy or sad. Stories make us happy or sad. I think we go to stories to feel happy or sad on purpose. Whereas noise filtering is based on an assumption of ignorance by the public. Facebook knows that we want to believe that everyone that follows us will see everything we post, and we want to believe that everything that comes to us in our newsfeed is everything that we post.
That's a whole other business issue where, of course, Facebook is charging for access, and you don't know what it's going to unless you pay them, which is a whole issue. But on the other hand, at Google Plus, they don't do the charging thing, but of course, no one of your millions of followers see everything that you write. That they have an algorithm
travesty,
that tries to improve the service. I know it is. Yes, they're robbed. Every one of them robbed.
Yes. Yeah, and it's It's the same solution that I would give to half the problems that we talk about on these shows when we're complaining about companies. I want transparency and control. That's what I want. I don't want a complete absence of transparency, and I don't want the removal of control. And that's essentially more or less what we've got right now. And I think that, you know, it's one thing to do noise filtering and just, okay, we trust Facebook to determine what our relationships are. Essentially, that's what they're doing. They're basically saying, you know what, you never like anything on Aunt Mildred's page. You never comment there. Therefore, you're not going to see anything from Aunt Mildred anymore. And we're severing that relationship. And you think that you still have that relationship and then just somebody's being quiet or they're out of sight, out of mind or whatever. But they're determining your relationships. That's the difference.
But that's a different issue from the happy or sad. There's an algorithm filtering at all. And you're objecting to that algorithm filtering at all, which means you object, I think, to both Facebook and Google Plus.
Yes.
In that sense,
I'm objecting to the lack of transparency. They should be really clear about it, because I talk to noobs all the time, and everybody's on Facebook, right? Everybody is on that's the social network for everybody, and the vast majority of people I talk to, they're like, really, they do that? They have no idea that there's noise filtering on Facebook. No idea.
Okay.
I want is you go to Facebook and there are buttons. Facebook, make me happy.
Yeah,
Facebook, make me thoughtful. Facebook,
right.
Make me angry. Make me melancholy. You know, show me the stuff. I'll either get kittens or I'll get lots of,
Gina, that's what BuzzFeed cats are made for. Exactly.
It's true. It'll be all upworthy when I want to feel hopeful and happy. get crazy.
I won't believe how I'm going to feel after I hit this button.
Wouldn't that be
surprise me with an emotion,
wonderful.
Facebook?
Make me feel nothing, Facebook. Okay, so let's talk about Android One, the platform, the reference platform that Google announced at Google I/O. This is for the next billion. They said it was for the next 5 billion. I thought that was a bit of a reach, but for the next billion, and what this is talking about is there are low cost phones are a necessity in many, many countries in the world, and many places of even wealthy countries. And so is that a horrible experience or is that a pretty darn good experience? And Google says that they want to make it a really good experience, even if this phone costs between $100 and $200 unlocked. And so Android One is their reference platform solution to this. They're starting out launching in India. And, of course, this is going to be rolled out across the globe. They'll be competing with all kinds of other companies going after this space. And to me, I think that this part of the conversation is part of another story that we've got in the rundown here, which is the idea that Google is feeling really compelled these days to lock down the experience, to not allow skins. It's the same thing with Android TV, Android Auto, Android Wear, and Android One. These are all theoretically versions of Android, and you're not allowed to put your own custom interface on it. Is this something that's going to come to the regular version of Android, do you guys think? What do you think, Gina?
Well, to me, I would have phrased it a little differently. I think that rather than lock in the one Android experience, I think that Google is, planting a flag and saying, this is the reference experience. This is a good Android experience. We're trying to create a model, right? Like Google knows that Android is a mobile operating system that's going to go out to the next billion people, that's going to go out to the rest of the world. And they don't want to leave the decision of what that experience is like to other manufacturers. You're going to load on, AOSP with none of the Google add-ons, right? They want to be first with that experience. I think it's great. I think Android One is a great thing. I mean, certainly I don't think being locked down is a good thing. And certainly I'm pro Android being open source, and I'm pro other companies, even if it's big companies like Amazon or Microsoft, building a layer on top of Android. But I really like that Google's taking the lead on defining what a good Android experience is for their next users.
Do you think this will increase, Gina, or decrease Amazon-like forks or the kind that you see in China where you see, huge numbers of Android users never use the Play Store, for example. They're not using the regular version of Google. Will this increase or decrease that? You see what I'm saying? Because on the one hand, it's like, companies who make phones might be like, well, if I can't put on my own stuff, then I don't want to play. That would increase the forks. And on the other hand, if it's really compelling and they've really got all the specs locked down and it's easy and low cost to do and you can make a lot of money, that would decrease it. So which way do you think it'll go?
I think the more Android users there are, the more forks there are going to be, and the more users there are going to be, and the better it is for Google, the better it is for everybody. I think that this is Android will be the first experience of getting online for a lot of people, and I think that opens up opportunities even for other manufacturers. But you're right, it could go both ways, but I think it's actually a good thing for Android. I think it means more Android for everyone, not just more Google Android.
Yeah, and I think it they're trying to have the cake and eat it too, and they might just accomplish it the way only Google can. Is that they get a lot of crap for the fragmentation, so this is a way to deal with that. But yet the open horse is out of the barn, and there are going to be, as Gina just said, a lot more versions of that, and you can kind of have a choice. I was at a Deutsche Welle conference in Bonn 2 days ago, and was talking with the head of a gigantic Indian public broadcaster there, and was talking about Android One starting in India, and he kind of shrugged and he said, we already have Android phones for $50, and we're an inch away from having tablets for $100. And so, yes, you'll have they're not knockoff Android, they're Android products at lower prices, or you can say, I want the quality experience, and that's not going to cost me a lot more, but I have a choice. And yeah. By the way, I want one of these Android One phones. I just can't wait to play with it and see how good it is.
Where would you get one in your neck of the woods? Will we be able to go in?
I don't know that we will. I mean, you know, next trip to India, I'll buy a couple in the airport.
Would you get me one, please? They're only $200. Yeah, I think that, you know, Google learned a lot from its experiences with the Moto G and also the Play, you know, the Google Play editions of the Samsung phones, the high-end phones. And, you know, I think they've gotten a lot of confidence that they really know what they're doing, oftentimes more than the OEMs know. And so it's really an interesting initiative, I think. There's so many companies are going after these markets, and I'm curious to see how low they'll go. Like you said, they're $50 phones. How low can it possibly go? $25 phones, $20 phones? Could be really crazy. Still, people struggle to pay the data rates in some of these countries, and that's an entirely different issue that Google, in fact, is potentially in a position to do something about as well. Well, let's talk about the right to be forgotten. I know, Jeff, that this is one of your many hot-button issues. It's one of mine, too. The reason we would talk about it again today is that this went into effect. Google is actually making stories and information forgotten, meaning that they're removing them from the Google Search Index. And The Guardian had a really great piece by James Ball talking about specific articles that were de-indexed on the Guardian newspaper. So this is a case, very strong case, a very clear case that really shows the reality of this ruling by the EU, that here are articles on the Guardian's newspaper site which cannot be found with the European version of Google Search. Jeff,
this is exactly what I've been screaming about in the show. And I know probably, you know, most of our audience, I imagine, is American, and I go off crazy about the Europeans and the Germans on these issues, and I don't mean to besmirch everybody with the same thing, but this was a god-awful decision, and it's now coming home to roost. Now, one might argue that Google is very cleverly, if not cynically, starting with de-indexing news stories for just this purpose. But fine, it proves the point. Both Guardian and now the BBC as well has had stories de-indexed for no good reason. There's nothing libelous, nothing wrong about them. Somebody didn't like them, didn't like what was said about them. And there's a whitewashing that is now enabled by the court. But more than that, it has an impact on free speech and freedom of the press. And my hope now is that not only Google, but also especially The Guardian and the BBC will go and sue at the European court to protect the freedom of press and the freedom of speech. Yes, those stories still exist on their sites, but people can't find them because Google was ordered by a government to take them down on behalf of people who didn't like what was said about them. Well, that affects the speech of those who said it. And that is the tool of tyrants. And it is shocking that this would come out of Europe, of all places, with its history. It just shows an absolute lack of understanding of how tyrants use the ability to change history.
Absolutely, and I couldn't say it better. That's exactly how I feel about it. And there's another element to this as well that really is really upsetting, which is that a search index exists to reflect what is on the internet. It's a card catalog. It's a terrible metaphor, but it's a card catalog for the library of the internet. And essentially what they're doing is they're ordering Google to have a search engine that's increasingly, and remember, this is cumulative, as they're continuously erasing
10,000 requests a day. 10,000 a day.
Exactly. So it's the search engine that everybody uses will not reflect what is actually on the internet. I mean, we're trying to have a society here. And here we have, a government-mandated requirement that search engines not reflect what is on the internet. It's a horrible state of affairs. Now, if they want to go after The Guardian and try to censor The Guardian, fine, go for it. There are free speech protections in place in most countries that certainly in Europe and certainly in the United States. So go try that. Go try to erase pages. And when you actually are enough of a tyrant to ban actual articles that have been published by The Guardian newspaper, then Google can change its search engine to reflect the fact that those have been censored. But this idea to go to the search engine and say, you know what, we're just going to make it so that people can't find it, this is really outrageous and really
I was delighted that Google apparently notified those whose articles were being taken down, yep. Though there is no appeal at this. Not from Google. This is an unappealable decision by the European court, nor from those whose articles are de-indexed. And so suddenly now your article is taken down because some subject of your article or your blog post or whatever has asked to be taken down because they don't like it. They say it's irrelevant. They say it's no good. Google takes it down. Google notifies you. There's no appeal on behalf of the censored party here. And that's wrong, too. This was such a numbnuts court decision, dangerous as can be. When I was at the Google Big Ten event, where, full disclosure, Google paid for my way over, not for me, about 3 weeks ago, what shocked me was I sat in the room, and I was a lone voice almost fighting against this decision. Google obviously wasn't crazy about it either. But politicians and people in the room, it just sounds cynically, okay, oh, what's wrong with being forgotten? It's okay. No, because it affects speech. So I'll shut up now.
I agree with you guys. But devil's advocate on the card catalog thing, like, I don't think that Google's index is actually a representation of everything that exists on the internet. Google filters spam. It filters pornography. It ranks based on its own internal factors, which is not transparent about. I mean, I agree with you about the right to be forgotten stuff, but Google makes a lot of other judgment calls about what content to show up in its results, particularly on the first page. So this isn't a new thing for them. You know, I saw the interview in the Times where I think it was Page. It was complaining, oh, we're going to have to make these decisions about whether or not this judgment call, whether or not we should take this thing out of the index. Google's already doing that that's what Matt Cutts' team does, right? So again, I'm playing devil's advocate, and I do agree with you guys.
That's an important point.
Yeah, it's
right. So then we get to the question. When I was at this Deutsche Welle event, my second trip to Germany in a few weeks, I was kind of debating. That was frustrating. We weren't allowed to. Matthias Döpfner, who's the head of Axel Springer, who's been a major Google foe, and arguing about this, and he brings up this argument of so-called search neutrality, which I've said on the show is an absurd concept because that equals only noise. So you're right. Google does make decisions based on relevance, authority, freshness, page rank, certain criteria of what's taken down, like porn. Those who ask for transparency to that are also asking for them to be gamed, so there is not transparency of it. That's all the given in the case. What makes this case different, I think, Gina, is that you have Google ordered by a government to follow these orders, to take down these things from people who are the subjects of things. And then there's no appeal. There's no appeal from the person who's been taken down. I think it's qualitatively different from an algorithm that prioritizes things.
There's another
dimension. I think you're right.
There's another dimension to it as well that's related to the one that you mentioned, Jeff, which is that when these things happen by the request or action of people in the public, what will inevitably happen, and this is a very un-European thing. Generally speaking, democracy in Europe, the United States, differs in its emphasis, where the United States tends to emphasize freedom over equality, whereas in Europe, especially France, they tend to emphasize equality over freedom. And here's a case where they're de-emphasizing equality, because who are the people who are going to request that information be taken down? It's going to be politicians, billionaires, wealthy people, you know, Smithers, get my, bad reputation cleaned up. They're going to have these reputation management companies that are very expensive, go and take this, get rid of whatever they can, whatever bad news or bad opinion or whatever it is they don't like, they'll attempt it. And so over the years, if this is allowed to stand, what'll happen is there'll be an imbalance in terms of the reputations and the good and bad information based on class, wealth, and so yes. on. And that is, to me, an extraordinarily un-European result.
Really good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is a good point.
There's another.
Although there's already an access issue around class and the internet, right? I mean, people who don't have access to the internet don't have no reputation.
Yeah.
but I yes. agree that this could worsen it.
There's another case, and I'm not sure if you guys talked about it on this show. I don't recall hearing it. That happened in Canada, where a judge in British Columbia ordered Google to block not only existing websites referencing a company, but all future references to that company.
And not just in Canada, but around the world.
That was the chilling part of it, wasn't it? Because once you have a precedent where, for any reason, a national government can essentially block something through the whole world or get out of the country, well, this is the greatest thing ever for China, for Iran, for, you know, any sort of authoritarian country you can imagine. And then, and what do you do? I mean, ultimately, it's just going to get worse and worse. The other part of this decision that was pretty awful, the Canadian decision, was that it applied only to Google. No other search engines were required to adhere to this ruling.
And by the way, that goes back to the right to be forgotten. We haven't heard yet, because that decision does apply to Bing and Yahoo et al. And it'll be interesting. I haven't heard what they're doing with this. And as I said when we started this discussion, I don't know this. I would suspect that Google prioritized the order of its takedowns, knowing that taking down press stories would get attention from the press. It would get their attention, and we need that. And I'm fine with that. I think that's if it's done for clever reasons, then cool. We are talking about it because The Guardian and the BBC wrote about this. Now it's time to go and ask what Bing and Yahoo are going to do about this. And it's time to see what whether there is any means of appeal to this. We're starting to learn that Google will give notice, but will notice be given by all parties to those who were taken down? There's no apparent means of appeal. And is there an opportunity for these censored parties to go and now sue for their own freedoms? We'll see. This was a dumb decision that's only going to get dumber.
Absolutely horrible. Well, the big story I think that remains undiscussed on this show, because you guys both came rushing to the studio last week from Google I/O, and they didn't start handing out watches yet, right? So we haven't talked about Android
right.
Wear.
We have not.
So let's go around the horn and find out, Gina, what do you think of Android Wear?
Oh, man, I love this thing. I've got the LG G Watch, and I'll tell you, my tweet-length review is the hardware is flimsy and bad, and the software is amazing. And now that's coming from someone who loves, I love Google Now, I live in Google Now, it's the first thing I look at in the morning, last thing I look at night. The fact that I have kind of Google Now and my notifications on my wrist, it means that I just don't look at my phone as much during the day, and that's something I like. I don't want to be the person who's got, you know, my face buried in my phone all day. It's very lightweight. The software is really delightful to use. It's a little rough around the edges and has to make some improvements. I don't use the voice control as much as I thought that I would. This is just a kind of text messaging notification system for me, but I really, really love it. And I can't wait to get the 360, because I think that's when the hardware, you know, has a shot at kind of catching up. I won't feel quite like I'm wearing such a nerd watch, but I am wearing this watch. The software is good enough that I'm actually wearing it. So,
how was the hardware flimsy, Gina?
I just think that the shape of the face, and it just feels kind of plasticky, and it just doesn't feel like a nice watch. It feels like I'm wearing this plastic old Casio, you know, it kind of screams nerd watch.
It's comfortable though, right?
It's comfortable and it's fine. It looks like I've got this computer on my wrist, right? And I would like for it to just look like I have a watch on, a nice watch. So I'm excited about the 360.
And an underappreciated fact of the 360 is that even though, as you can agree, Gina, the LG G Watch is very light, the 360 is significantly lighter.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I wouldn't have expected that with the stainless steel.
It kind of looks pretty heavy. So, Jeff, what do you think of yours?
I also got the LG. I'm also wearing it every day. I'm also loving it. And I'm coming to big, you know, conclusions about my world and our world of news with it. Because I think that the primary benefit to me so far has been has indeed been news updates, right? So I saw Supreme Court decisions, things like that come across. Now, generally, news companies are actually ironically awful at updates. They either do too many or they don't do any at all. But so far, I'm getting Guardian updates, I think New York Times updates, and Circa updates on this. And they're using them sparingly, that it pretty much works. It's pretty much valuable. I'm finding the user interface still fairly clunky, trying to get around and do stuff. It constantly tells me I have zero steps when, by God, I've been walking. I'd have to go turn on Fit. I wish there were some other things that I could have an update for me. The most fundamental weakness to me of this is that I use my Shine still. I haven't updated in a few days, but I use it partly because it can tell my sleep. This doesn't do my sleep. But worse than that, I have to charge it every night, so I don't have a watch on knowing the time, and I'm blind without these. So when I was in a hotel room the last few nights and they didn't have a clock, I don't know what time it is. I'm waking up and I'm jet lagged. Not having this on at night, to me, is an issue. It's almost like you need to have two of them, you know, a day version and a night version, and soon we will. but I agree with Gina. I'm looking at my phone less. I'm finding it comfortable to wear this all the time. I said on the show last week that I think that the computer is going to migrate from the phone into this device, and this becomes our identity, and this becomes our primary computer, and everything else is a slave of it. And we're seeing the transition to that in terms of how Android is now the master of all. I haven't used the voice either, and it's funny because it just seems too stupid Dick Tracy-ish. I was on the plane coming back, and I dictated a tweet on my phone. I didn't feel weird about that, but I feel weird about doing this, especially starting with, okay, Google. And it also isn't great at hearing me, I don't find. So now I'm trying to get it to go to that, and I can't get it to go back to the home. Okay, now. Okay, Google. Oh, it did it. Search for Gina Trapani. No, it gave me audit.
That seems really awkward.
Yeah.
But what's interesting, I think, to me about the experience of wearing it is that it immediately becomes clear that, yes, smartwatches, we're all going to be wearing them. They it's such a great place for information, for contextual information, for notifications. It's a great place for Google Now. Google Now really never had a place before. You had to go find it. You had to seek it out and say, oh, I'm going to use Google Now, at this point. And that's not how Google Now really needs to be used. It needs to be ambient. No. It needs to be just kind of there. And now it's just there. It's on the wrist. And that's fantastic.
I'm going to try an experiment. Okay, Jarvis. Oh, it didn't work.
Oh, that's sad.
It works for us if we say it. You'll usually reply, "What? What do you want?" But it's what's amazing to me is that this is an app, and I've said this on a couple of other shows here at Twit, but it's the first platform with a killer app, which is Google Now. Right out of the box, it's already got its killer app. Done.
Yeah.
Killer app.
Well said.
And just wait till the apps come, which July 7th they start coming out. And, a year from now, how many apps are going to be out there and what are they going to be able to do? It's really exciting that it's already so useful. It's already so comfortable to wear, especially if you're used to using Google Glass, where you have to kind of psych yourself up to go outside into public. You can just wear this thing around. You can relax and really use it in a sort of like invisible way without making a big scene. Without
now, has anyone outside your two geek circles was too obvious or no, you just came back from I.O.? In any kind of setting with a waiter or a waitress or somebody on the street, has anybody come up to you and said, "What's that?"
No, nobody
nope.
has.
No, nope.
It's completely invisible.
My daughter noticed it. I mean, because she saw me fiddling with it. She's one, so she touches it a lot. Like because she sees me touching it. So that's kind of funny. And actually, her favorite thing to do is to palm it to turn it off. And Jason and I were talking about this last night. Like, if you have kids, especially young kids, it's very sensitive to touch. So if the baby touches it or if I pick it up and her clothes brush it, it comes on. I actually did just fall in bed last night with it on, and then it kind of hit the pillow and came on and lit up my wife's face, she was not happy about it. It's not a good sleeping thing. Like, especially in the dark when the screen gets really bright, she was like, get that thing off of you. I was like, whoops, sorry.
My wife thinks it's dumb that it comes, that it's on all the time. She thinks it should be blank, but I said, no, my watch, you know, has time on it, but she just thinks it's dumb. The other problem is I cross my arms like this and it turns it on all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very sensitive.
And you hear it, it goes zzz, and it like buzzes. I do that all the time. I do this and all of a sudden it's buzzing and I'm like, is that a notification?
Now, what about the Motorola seems to have in the stem spot?
Yeah.
Is that a button or is that just a detection?
It's a button. It turns it on and off and you can sort of reset it and reboot it. It's unnecessary because you can do that, obviously. The LG G Watch has no buttons at all, no physical buttons. So, yeah, it's a button to turn it on and off. I think they just like the look of it. They really wanted that you know,
did you also get the LG, Mike?
I did. Yeah, I have the LG as well.
Did anybody around you get the Samsung? Everybody there seemed to be getting the Samsung. What did Jason think of the Samsung? Have you compared?
We have. We did it on Before You Buy yesterday, and he likes it a lot. There are pros and cons. Generally, the Samsung's a little cheaper. It's just under $200, where this is $229. The Samsung has a brighter screen, a smaller battery, but longer battery life, which is impressive because it uses a screen that doesn't show. It doesn't light up pixels if there's no, you know, if it's not using those pixels, it doesn't use any energy on those pixels. And it's a great watch. He likes it a lot. It's a little bigger, bulkier. There's a little bit more chrome. I really think it's a little bit of a wash. Maybe the Samsung sort of.
Are the watch faces the same on both?
Identical.
The choices of watch faces?
Oh, that.
And by the way,
I don't know.
They're
actually
really mostly ugly as sin.
Yeah.
Which
one
are you guys using? I'm using this one.
Yeah, that's the one I use, too. I like that one. It's nice and basic.
But I wanted to really get a nice, you know, fool you, this is a real watch, and they're pretty ugly. Which one are you using, Gina?
I'm using Mini Neon, which is a little hipster for my taste, but it was the closest I could find. It's a little designy and bright, but it was, like, the closest I could find to something that I liked. You're right. I would like to see more watch faces. It's got the time. It's kind of hard to see on my screen.
Some of these
it's called
are
Mini Neon,
really ugly, like this one.
Yeah. What's the deal with that? It's like Peter Max or something. I mean, it's like, you know, it's psychedelic 70s. I don't know what it is. Like, it's like a children's show from the 70s or something like that. It's really quite horrible. And this is another example of.
Yeah, that's the one I'm using. The one that looks like a children's show from the 70s with the number coming out. Yeah, it was like the least bad one, I thought.
Yeah.
But that's an opportunity. The watch faces is definitely an opportunity.
This is another example of how the Moto 360 is probably going to dominate. They've already had a contest for people to sort of crowdsource awesome.
So there is going to be open source design. I mean, we can download watch faces we like, right?
I'm almost certain that is the case. And you know, a year from now, there are going to be tens of thousands of watch faces to choose from, and so that's going to be kind of cool. But yeah, the ones out of the box for the LG G Watch are, you know, pretty slim pickings if you want a good-looking watch, I thought.
So. I can't wait for the Rolex knockoff.
Yeah.
Watch face.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one other question that somebody wrote about this week is the question of whether or not Android Wear sort of invalidates or makes obsolete Google Glass. They have similar functions in terms of their, you know, app extensible, notification-oriented, Google Now-oriented wearable devices. The biggest difference, I think, besides the fact that Google Glass lives on your face, is that Google Glass has a camera that you point at everybody you look at, and that's the biggest controversial point about Google Glass. But is this the end of Google Glass as a consumer product? And you know, obviously, Google Glass might have a life as a sort of vertical integrated business, you know, device. But is it over for Google Glass because of Android Wear? What do you think, Jeff?
That was my argument on the show last week, was just that it obsoletes two-thirds of the functions of Google Glass, notifications and instructions or directions, and a far more convenient, far better structure. I don't want that up here. And I think Google Glass does show the power of having a camera so that, as Gina has often pointed out, your baby sees you, not some box in front of your eyes, and the images that you're taking are of what you actually see. I think that's proven to be valuable, but clearly it's going to have to come with a red light and a siren that says, okay, I'm taking a picture of you now. Okay, with that, okay. And a way to notify people that it's there. And so I see glass nose cameras of some sort coming, completely separate from the functionality of Google Glass, I mean, of Android Wear. And I wouldn't mind having that either. I think that has journalistic opportunities, but I don't think the other functionality works very well up here. Gina?
Yeah, I mean, I do agree that Android Wear, the watch, is a much more appealing product for most consumers that gives you most of the functionality of Glass. I don't think that Glass is dead. I think it's just it's a niche market. You know, I imagine going to Coney Island and I'm about to get on the Ferris wheel and they say, you know, do you want to rent a pair of Glass to take video, right? Like, or I'm going to get on a zip line. It's an experience thing. The heads up, the sort of the camera on your head thing. That's not something that you need on a daily basis. And even just being able to speak to your face computer isn't something that people really want. I think the watch is like, people want a way to stay in touch without constantly being buried in their phone. I think that that's a problem. I think it's an issue. I think Microsoft has done commercials around people falling into mall fountains or whatever, just being, you know, staring at their phone all day. I think for people who are hyper-connected, the watch, you know, is a much more appealing product, especially because people don't stop and ask you about it. And it's not banned in theaters and that kind of thing. But I don't think Glass is dead, but the watch is definitely much more.
If we'd had Larry Page there, the big question is if this is emasculating, is this? And for those on audio, I was saying that Larry said looking at your phone all day was emasculating. Somehow Google Glass was not.
Was that Sergey or was that Larry?
Where does the watch come in? Was it Sergey? Maybe it was. I don't know which one it was. That's true. Which one was it?
Might have been Sergey.
That was an educational moment for me because I didn't realize that emasculate could mean something other than something gender related. Like it actually means like weakening. And I think what he was trying to say is it breaks down. It makes you less present in the world. It was a bad choice of words, or maybe it was a good choice. We're still talking about it. That was like a year, a while ago, wasn't it?
Yeah. But they're sure. I think we can all agree that the comfort level of using Android Wear is very high, surprisingly high, and that differentiates it massively from Google Glass, which is a little uncomfortable. Really cool. It was really cool at first. It's still cool. I kind of like Google Glass. It's great to be able to, you know, take pictures and, you know, I wear it when I'm trail running and stuff like that, and I see a deer and I take a picture, and then the picture comes out and it's a like little tiny picture of a deer that nobody cares about, but it's really kind of cool to be able to do that. If there's an alien invasion and I get abducted or whatever, I'm going to have some good video. But for the most part, I'm really loving the Android Wear. I think we all do, and I'm really looking forward to the apps. So again, that's coming next week. Well, speaking of new platforms, Gina, have you got a chance to play with Android L's developer preview?
Oh, man, I have not had a chance to play with it, and it's because my Nexus 7 is a little too old, and I don't have a Nexus 5. My wife does, and I wanted to swap with her so I could install the preview, but my co-host on All About Android last night, we had Ron Amadeo on from Ars Technica, who's written extensively about the L preview. He said, you know, it's just not ready it's not ready to be your daily driver, right? And, you know, I've got a kid in daycare, like my phone's got to work, right? Like my phone can't crash. I need to get phone calls. So I have not installed it because I just don't have the hardware laying around to test it out. And it looks, and we did a nice long review kind of last night on All About Android at it. It's beautiful, but it's still rough. It very much is a preview. Like this isn't a beta. This is a developer preview. So it's killing me because, man, does it look good? Does it look good? I'm like, material design is amazing. But unfortunately, I'm going to be developing in the simulator for now.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are a couple of L's laying around in the Twit Studios, Mike.
Not that I've seen. I'll check.
Jason
has Padre's one. Chocolate.
Yeah, I think Jason's done it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I haven't talked to anybody here who's looked at that, but you've obviously been reading about it and you know, you've been talking a lot about it, but for those watching and listening who are not super familiar on the material design, can you explain exactly what that is and why you're excited about it?
Well, I'm not a designer, but the idea of material design is the idea that the design of Android is that this kind of card-based design, which we've already seen in Google Now, but the idea is that the cards and the movement is very tactile, that the design of the interface, that the items of the interface behave as if they were objects in real space. So there's this idea of height and Z-index where cards can be above the rest of the interface. The cards kind of scroll and bounce and list very naturally. Things don't just teleport from one side to the other. They slide and shift. You have this hero image that you just saw pop that then just kind of contracts as you scroll up. Everything is extremely smooth and fast, and it behaves as if it's card stock, as if there were cards laid out on the table and you were moving them around, except that they can change shape, obviously, because it's digital. You have nice shadows and buttons that can kind of overlay. It's a complete overhaul of Android's default theme, which right now is Holo. So this material design is a success for the Holo, and it takes over the entire interface of Android, and any apps that use the default theme will also get the material design upgrades. And as far as I can say, it's beautiful and it's fast, and it looks like this really beautiful evolution of kind of skeuomorphism plus flat design. You know, it's flat design, but it's even better because it feels very natural. That the idea is that your brain thinks about objects in space the way they actually, you know, act in physical space, and to try to create that experience on the phone to make it more intuitive. And from what I've seen, the previews and the videos and the screenshots, they've done a really, really nice job, and I'm really excited actually about converting my app over to Material Design, and which means that Google did their job at I/O, because that was the whole idea, is to convince developers and get them excited about this new theme, this new design.
It's really incredible. Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, just a quick question, Gina, on that. When you redesign your app for that, does that mean it's yet more fragmentation, that all the earlier versions of Android won't be there? How much effort does that take, and what's the payoff?
It depends on how much customization that you do. So my app is a to-do list app. It's a very, very simple app. It uses standard, Android UI elements, lists, and, you know, scrolling, and the hamburger menu with the slide-out menu. These are default UI widgets or objects that Android provides, and I didn't do a whole lot of customization. So for me, it's going to be very, very simple. For apps that have custom designs that aren't kind of your standard Android stuff, it's a little harder. Maybe you don't switch to material design at all if you decide to design your app completely custom. But it's, for the most part, all of these improvements in material design you get mostly for free. If you're already using default Android widget, you know, UI elements, you get these updates for free, which is really nice.
That's very
cool.
When
you said that was a phrase used a lot last week at I/O, you get them for free.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean the obvious, that otherwise you'd pay for them. What does it mean?
It means that there's no extra effort on my part as a developer. I don't have to recompile my APK. I don't have to write new source code. It just runs. It just works, right? So that's why, you know, when they were saying with Android Wear that if your app has notifications on Android, it works on Android Wear, because Android Wear just detects those notifications.
So
I don't have to
free.
Recompile and re-upload for free, right? Meaning no
Thank
more
you.
Extra cost or investment on my part as a developer.
It's really fascinating to see Google's rapid transition from essentially ignoring and almost having a contempt for anything that resembles design just a few years ago to being so good at design. Their apps have been beautiful for a while. Their iOS apps have been beautiful for a while. The redesign, you know, the design of Google Plus is very nice, and the cards interface is beautiful. And now this, it's just, they've just gone from the back of the class to the front of the class. And it's really great to see. They finally understand the design isn't about decoration. It's about usability and user happiness, really.
I mean, we saw this on the web, too, right? Like, Android's iteration evolution has been this, like, sped-up process that we saw on the web, right? I mean, back in the day, Google was, it was a list of blue links, right? It was like the default browser blue. And in a lot of ways, it still is that, right? But we see a lot more design and things like, I look at the new modern apps like Google Keep, and I'm just like, this is gorgeous what they did here. When they launched forever ago, I think either Larry or Sergey were photoshopping the Google logo themselves. They've come a long way. And I feel like the Android evolution has been just an accelerated version of what we've seen on the web.
And Gina, speaking of things that you get for free, what is your current thinking about Project Volta? I mean, it sounds great right out of the bat. Project Volta is a huge initiative that will enable Android devices to really be careful with battery life. It'll extend battery life, essentially. That'll be the end result for end users, that with the same battery, with the same everything else, the phone will last a lot longer between charges. But there's a downside. There are downsides to it, of course, that it turns off services. It doesn't do anything super magical. It just manages the things that are running. For example, it won't launch something that requires an internet connection if there's no internet connection present, that sort of thing. But what you're thinking as a developer about Project Volta, is this something that's going to be transformative, or could this be problematic? What are you thinking about this?
I mean, it sounds like advantages that you also kind of get for free. I mean, when you're developing for a mobile app, you have to think about things like slow connections and intermittent connections and non-existent connections and small screens and low processing power. And as Android, the system can help me manage that better. You know, if my app doesn't work, if there's no internet connection, it's a bad user experience. If the user launches the app and it just says, oops, sorry, right? So if Android handles that for me, that's great. Bring it on. Like, that's just less work that I have to do. I mean, there's certain problems that every mobile app has to deal with, particularly around intermittent connections and slow connections and bad connections. And so anything that the Android, the system can handle, I'm like, bring it on. That's great. And if your app is so battery hungry that Volta is killing it on a regular basis, I mean, that's more motivation for me as a developer to optimize even more.
That's a great point. Well, I think we should do the Google changelog if we have the timpanis ready and the trumpets. So why don't we launch into that?
The Google changelog.
This is a relatively light changelog post-IO, but we do have a couple of little things. First, this was spotted by Android Central. Google Voice for Android now has emoji support, so you can send all the happy faces that you want. I tried it out today. It works really great on Google Voice for Android. However, I got what I think you pronounce it, Mojibaki. Is that how it's called? What it's called?
When
it messes up emoji. Yeah, on the web, Google Voice the web, I did not see my emoji, but it does work from Google Voice to a regular SMS carrier and back. So that's a welcome addition for those of us who like our smiley faces. Let's see. Oh, video hangouts no longer require a plugin on the desktop. So Google has officially deprecated the Hangouts plugin for Chrome on the developer and Canary channels of the Chrome browser, meaning that Hangouts video functionality is now completely built into the browser. So this feature is going to roll out to all Chrome users in the next weeks, which is really nice. Just means you don't have to install an extra extension. Sad news for Orkut users. Remember Orkut? It was pre-Google Plus.
In other words, you Brazilian viewers.
You Brazilians, yes. Yes, bad news for Brazilian users. Google is shutting down Orkut, first social networking effort back in the day acquired. I guess they launched it in 2011. Not 2011. That's Google Plus. Sorry about that. Actually, I don't know.
2004, I believe. I think it's 10 years old.
Yeah. Long 10 years old.
Yep.
Yes. So they're shutting it down to focus on other social networking businesses like YouTube, Blogger, and Google Plus. So
I do believe Kevin Marks worked on Orkut for a while, as I remember.
Oh, yeah. You know, you might be right. You might be right.
It was a 20% time project, and you know, I used it at the beginning, and then pretty soon everything was in Portuguese, and then, you know.
Yes.
So. It was also big in India for a while.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Is, or was, I guess. They're shutting it down September 30th, I believe it is.
So is there there's nothing you can do to transport your friends anywhere else or anything?
You can export your profile data and posts and photos using Google Takeout from Orkut, and that'll be available till September 2016. So you've got some time if you got some Orkut data.
You know, and I understand them getting rid of it. I don't have any problem with it in the long run. But there is. I remember I talked about this long ago when my daughter was on the American Girl site that'll be coming to you soon, Gina. I think Mattel owns the company and owned the site, and it was a safe place where she could have friends, and suddenly they just killed it, and it was like destroying the town, right? You have a bit of a social responsibility when you create the platform for a community and then you kill the platform and the community just goes boom.
Right, there's no space for them to go to anymore. Yeah. It is. You really kind of need someone to make an organized move over. I feel like even beyond Google Takeout, Google could do something like create an Orkut community on Plus or create some sort of alternate space.
Well, I've heard that they are going to provide a tool. It's not available yet to actually automatically transition Orkut profiles to Google Plus profiles. chat room.
Then you've got to transition all your, you're losing your friends too. You're losing the thing that matters to you.
Yeah, exactly.
And again, I understand why they're doing it. They kill things that aren't working. We've been making Orkut jokes for years. But still, there's some responsibility to a community when you start it. And I think that's an issue going forward.
Yeah. Hey, you said it was okay for Facebook to sever my relationship with Aunt Mildred. What's the difference here?
That's right.
I guess I don't know anybody in Brazil. So, so is that it, Gina? Is that the changelog?
One last shutdown. This is actually a feature that wasn't available here in the U.S., but Google had actually introduced SMS for Hangouts on the web. Of course, we know that it exists in Hangouts for Android. So they had offered that, and up until now, that feature was available in India, Pakistan, Israel, Turkey, Ukraine, Congo, and other countries in Africa and Asia. They are currently shutting that down as well. They're saying that the service will be discontinued, and for other regions, it just says the service isn't available. So not sure what's going on there. I mean, we saw quite a bit at Google I.O. about getting text messages from Android onto Chrome OS. I would love to see that actually just in Chrome, so you don't have to be on a Chromebook to get that. But I wouldn't be surprised if we saw another iteration of getting SMS on the desktop for everyone soon. But for now, that experimental feature for those countries is no longer available.
And there were stories related to this, before we play the trumpets again, that we're talking about evidence that Google is going to be moving Google Voice people to Hangouts and building some of the Google Voice functionality into Hangouts. And in there somewhere would be another way to integrate SMS with Hangouts. But I have to be honest, I read multiple articles and none of them were all that clear. And I still am not certain about exactly what the evidence is and what the information is and what's going to happen. But I think that logically speaking, it makes a lot of sense that Google Voice be folded into and integrated with Hangouts, that some of the Google Voice functionality, hopefully all the Google Voice functionality. I'm a voice user. There are certain things in Google Voice that I really would rather not live without. And if they're going to move it to Hangouts, bring all that stuff with
them. The only thing I have to say is that I am to this day confused about SMS in Hangouts.
Yeah.
I end up sending a message to my son on his Google account instead of his phone.
And so it's all very, very confusing. There are many things about Hangouts that are confusing. For example, why can't they turn off people calling me from Pakistan in the middle of the night? Like, why can't they turn
really?
That off? Yeah, it happens to me all the time, from all over the world, and I just can't figure out how to turn it off. But this whole SMS thing, when they first launched it, and I believe it's still the case, a person's SMS is treated like a different person from that person as you know them on Google+, Gmail, and so on.
Right.
And it's very easy to mix them up. But the other thing, the story that Gina's talking about, as I understand it, is not that. It's not that use of SMS via Hangouts. It's the transmission of Hangout messages via the SMS system.
Right.
And so it's super complicated. Nobody knows what's going on with Hangouts and SMS. And it's terrible because Google needs to fix this. Hangouts is super central to what Google is trying to accomplish. And they need to make it clear and easy and, frankly, more FaceTime-like or more iMessage-like, I guess I should say, where you basically can just send someone a message. And, the company takes care of how it gets there. And if everybody's using Hangouts, fine, it goes by Hangouts. If they're not, it goes by SMS, fine. But it's all, sort of behind the scenes. I don't want to have to stress out about who I'm contacting, how I'm contacting them. And I don't want people calling me in the middle of the night.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, we're still waiting for the unified messaging platform that Google promised, it was like 2 IOs ago. And I don't know with Google Voice. I mean, I hope they build it into Hangouts. It feels like Google Voice is either on the edge of getting killed or this amazing roll-up upgrade into Hangouts where everything just works. I feel like if Google shuts down Voice, it will have a worse situation on its hands than it did when Google Reader closed, because I think that there's a very strong and vocal user base of power users who love Voice and have used it for a really long time. I think most people don't know what Voice is, but I think that the people who do know what Voice is are folks like us who switch phones and who are privileged in that way and that have a need for the one number to rule them all.
Yeah.
So I hope that they don't shut it down, because I think it will be a serious PR issue if they do.
And for those watching or listening who are not familiar with the feature set of Google Voice, essentially the killer there are many features, but the killer features are that you can add multiple phones. You can have landline phones, cell phones, and they're all attached to your single Google Voice number. So people call, and then you can determine which phones ring, whether they all ring, whether none of them rings between certain hours. You can block callers. So if you're getting telephone spam, you can block that number, and Google will lie for you and tell those callers it'll play a fake, this number is no longer in service recording, which is crazy, really, that they would be willing to lie by copying the official telephone system's no longer in service message. And features like that. But that's what's really great. You can swap out other numbers, and you can have a lot of control over your numbers. That's how phones should work, really. That's how contacting people on a phone should work. So, yeah, please keep all of those features if you're going to move it to Hangouts, because those are very, very powerful. And, yeah, like you said, people are passionate about voice because it's, you start using it, and you just need it.
You can't turn back. Yeah.
Absolutely. So we have a closer for the changelog. Shouldn't we play that? There we go.
Thank you, Chad.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, okay. So let's talk about the Supreme Court's refusal to hear Google's Street View appeal. Now, just to set up the story, some time ago, a few years ago, a couple of years ago, Google was caught harvesting data from people's home Wi-Fi, small business Wi-Fi, as their Street View cars roamed through the streets and just sucking down data, taking, in some cases, passwords, anything it could. It turns out that, Google officially threw a rogue engineer under the bus, saying that this project was something done without official corporate authorization. They should have copped to the fact that it's possible for employees to do things like that without the company's knowledge or permission. But the Supreme Court basically said, and Google was sued. They lost the lawsuit. Google wanted the Supreme Court to look at it, and the Supreme Court said no. And that's the end of it. So there's no higher court. The Supreme Court wants.
Well, but I think this was, and I didn't read the. I saw the stories quickly, but as I recall, this allows the case. Google was trying to stop the case from going on. This now allows the case to go on. So I don't think it's fully settled yet. I could be wrong about that. Chat room, correct me, as I know you will, if I'm wrong.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good point. But I do want to talk about the question. And the truth be told, I'm hoping, Jeff Jarvis, that you'll be one of the only people in the world to agree with my opinion on this. but my opinion is essentially this. The way this story has been characterized in the press since this was first uncovered is that Google Street View cars were driving around and reaching into people's homes and reaching into their Wi-Fi routers and grabbing information, when in fact, the way that works is that the Wi-Fi information is under the control of the owner, theoretically, whether it's encrypted or not encrypted, whether it's password protected or not password protected. And those things are broadcast out into the street, out into the public street. And a car passing by, everything that passes by is going to be washed over by these electromagnetic radiation, essentially. And so the idea that you would pay attention to it, that you would see it, that you would capture it. It's similar to when if you open up a Wi-Fi network in the restaurant next door, you can see their Wi-Fi password. That you're actually connecting to their router to a certain extent. That information is coming to you and you're seeing it, right? So to capture and record what is on a public street, essentially, it's not polite. You know, it's not nice. They shouldn't have done it, as they've admitted. But it doesn't seem to me like a super wrong thing to do either. It's kind of as if it's literally like somebody put a big TV set in the window facing out toward the street with their personal password on it, and then having somebody walk by and go, writing it down, and then them getting in trouble for writing it down. The person who was in control of that information broadcast it into the public sphere. And so it just doesn't seem as wrong as it sounds on its face. What do you think, Jeff?
Oh, I agree, and we've talked about this on the back when this case happened in the U.S. and Europe. This is stuff that is broadcast on public and open airwaves. You're right; it was stupid and rude and unnecessary for Google to take it. But it's also been the case that in technopanic land, that people have argued that Google has some great conspiracy to do this, and just the absurdity of that. You know, the odds that something of value is going to be caught when the car, when on the day when the car happens to drive by in 3 minutes and catches something. And the idea that Google had any business model for doing anything with this data is absurd. Also, people were ignorant about the fact that there are other companies besides Google that capture Wi-Fi router addresses so that they can be used in geolocation software that we all depend upon. And that's all okay, and nobody talks about that, and it's not a big deal. Problem here was that Google took too much data. That data was absolutely useless. They were stupid to take it. It caused them huge PR hell and now legal hell. But there was no possibility of a business conspiracy behind it. And it's once again a case of an ignorant court or set of courts that don't know enough about the technology to understand how to rule to the principle. They've had an impact on the definition of public now. And just as the cases against Google Street View in some countries, especially in Europe, have an impact on the notion of what's public, that's going to have, I think, a precedent that could be harmful in other cases.
Gina, do you have a view on this? Do you have an opinion one way or the other?
I agree with you guys. I mean, Google, obviously, it was a bug in the software that prevented the software from discarding that data, right? I mean, they were just collecting the access point information, not the data that was passing to and from it, right? Look, it was a bug in the software. They collected the data. I think that they did it by mistake. That's what they said. Look, this is the reason why Google blurs out faces in Street View pictures, right? And why we redact personal information from public documents. Like, they should have discarded it. They didn't. They made a mistake. The law that they purportedly broke was the federal wiretap law,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Which is absurd.
The Wiretap Act. Which, I think that indicates sort of a misunderstanding of the technology as there is so often in these kinds of cases. So, look, this is the case that means that the FCC is going to be babysitting Google for like the next 20 years, right? Aren't they doing privacy audits of Google, yep, for the next 20 years, yeah, because of this? Look, like, I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing. And I know, Jeff, I'm sorry. I think it's good that Google's aware that, you know, buggy software or, you know, something they're doing in the interest of their business, you know, could have these kinds of effects. But this seems like a bummer ruling, and I think that they should have heard the appeal.
Yeah, I agree. Well, yep. Why don't we do our picks and tips and number of the week? Who normally goes first on this show? Is it Leo or Gina? Do you go first?
Gina.
All right,
yeah,
Gina,
I think I usually go first.
Always ladies first.
So this tip comes from the Google Operating System blog, great blog covering Google, particularly around products. And it's just a little tip. If you, the new Google Maps came out quite some time ago, but if you haven't thought about the old Google Maps, or if you missed the old Google Maps, there's a little short URL, a secret URL that can take you to the old classic Google Maps, and that is google.com/local. I gotta tell you, I haven't looked at the old Google Maps in a really, really long time. I went to this URL today just to kind of check it out, and it felt like I was just seeing an old friend. I was like, yes. I think there are a few things that the new Google Maps does. It tries to be a little too smart, a little too predictive for me. Sometimes I'm like fumbling around trying to figure out how to get to one view or the other. So it was kind of cool to see the old Google Maps. This URL might not work for very long. I'm sure that they're going to phase out the old maps, the classic maps, soon. But if you haven't looked at the old maps after using the new map for a while, go to google.com/local and you can enjoy a little bit of nostalgia.
Gina, I am totally using this as my default view for Google Maps for as long as I can. And here's why. I hate the new maps because the card on the upper left-hand, yep, corner always covers. And I try to get,
yes,
rid of it, and I kind of lose control, and it's frustrating.
Exactly.
I like the old ones.
Yes. Same here.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
yeah.
Thank you for that tip. I'm
sure,
absolutely going to make this my default Google Maps view. So, Jeff, what do you have number-wise?
Let's mention two things real quick. One, I want to mention this just quickly, that Google is offering free lessons in coding to thousands of women and minorities, and it couldn't happen soon enough.
Yep.
Not only have Google and Facebook and other companies revealed their less than stellar diversity numbers, but also just culturally, we're seeing just a rat-a-tat-tat of cases of women being treated badly in technology companies. And the only solution to that is to have more people doing it. And I want to plug one of my students, Otto Bernier, one of my graduates, has a business called Skill Crush that is aimed at teaching women how to code. And the more we have, the better. Right, Gina?
Absolutely. Love Skill Crush.
But the number I wanted to do for this week was that Google is so far, the Google Cloud platform is 8-for-8 in World Cup predictions. So who needs to watch the World Cup when you have Google?
Exactly. That's my point. Exactly. I've been trash talking soccer in general for this whole
zero,
week.
Zero.
It's not a good, it's
Bill,
a lonely
zero,
place.
Zero, zero, zero.
Gosh,
it's so funny. When I was in Frankfurt the other night coming back here, and it was before the Germans were going on, and so people were out at restaurants on the streets, just like TVs were everywhere. The funny thing was to listen. Soccer sounds like such a painful sport because it's constantly all you hear from the distance is
for three hours and nothing happens.
Yeah,
yeah. Jason and I yesterday were doing. Before you buy, during the Belgium USA game, and we hear these enormous cheers coming out of the break room, and we thought, oh, you know, the U.S. must have scored. No, the U.S. kind of, sort of, almost scored, and that was like super exciting. Apparently, that the ball got within the general proximity of the goal. Yeah, it's awful. I just can't do it. You know, I'm not a sports guy anyway,
oh,
but soccer.
We're gonna get flamed.
Yeah, it's. And boy, I hear it on Google Plus. I have so many friends all over the world, and we have these big arguments about, you know, whether it's called football or soccer. And you know, we had a big pissing contest yesterday about how many English speakers, native English speakers, or people who speak English fluently as a second language, use soccer versus football. And yeah. It was very an interesting conversation, but it always comes up. And then these conversations about what's better, you know, American football or international football. Always end with the Australian saying, "Yeah, you know what? Rugby. That's the best sport in the world." Always.
Well, I got the important sports news of the day is Federer won. Yay.
Yeah, there you go. All right, so let's do my tool. There is a Kickstarter project that I would love for everyone to back so that I can buy it, called Pelty. Pelty is a speaker that is powered not by plugging it in. It's not powered by batteries. It's powered by a single candle. And one candle will play your, and it's Bluetooth, so it's wireless. There are no wires visible. There's no nothing visible. And it'll play for 8 hours with one little votive-like candle. This is great for the coming apocalypse, the end of the world where there's no electricity. And all you need is a shotgun, a machete, and one of these, and you should be fine in the post-apocalyptic.
Mike, has anyone told you lately that you have too much disposable income?
maybe. But this is, this is kind of cool. Not only does it play nice music, but it's also very, you know, creates a kind of ambiance.
Date night.
Yeah, there you go. And look, there's the hook right there. That's an Android phone. So,
of course, you're going to get confused. You're going to start burning your phone by putting a candle underneath it.
That's right. Well, you know, if I do that, I'll have to get a new phone, which would be fine anyway. You know, like you said, too much disposable
income. Too much disposable income.
Well, that concludes this edition of This Week in Google. I want to thank you, Jeff and Gina. Thank all of you for tuning in today.
Good job, Mike.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
Boy, Leo makes this look easy. And it is not. It makes it look so easy.
What? Are you saying we're difficult to deal with? Is that what you're saying here, Elgin?
Yes, I am. No, I'm not. You guys are wonderful. I love the show. I'm the biggest fan of the show and always have been. For a long time, and I always love to either be on the show, as I've done once or twice before, and hosting it is absolutely fantastic because I get to talk back, I get to engage with you guys, but I never miss a single word of the show. I absolutely love it. Jeff Jarvis is professor of journalism at the University of New York and author of Public Parts, What Will Google Do?, and Gutenberg the Geek. He blogs at buzzmachine.com. Thank you so much, Jeff Jarvis. And Gina Trapani is creator of ThinkUp.com, host of Twits All About Android, with the lovely and talented Jason Howell as well, founding editor of Lifehacker. Thank you so much, Gina Trapani. We do This Week in Google every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern. That's 2000 UTC. You can watch the show live at live.twit.tv, or you can subscribe to the show at twit.tv/2. Twig. There are many, many subscription options available. Thank you for joining us today. Leo and the gang will see you next time on Twig.